Howdy and welcome to Thin Air, news with an altitude from your small town Rocky Mountain public radio stations. I'm John Kovash.
I'm Gina Garacio. Howdy. This month we go behind bars. We have a report from Boulder on the effort to put a moratorium on prison building in Colorado.
And from Durango, a report on a county jail where mistreatment of prisoners has attracted international attention.
We do have the electric restraint device here.
And from Aspen, a photographer looks at how Colorado's landscapes have changed in 100 years.
It's pretty darn alarming and shocking.
From Moab, there's a growing movement to drain Lake Powell.
No longer would it be an environment that is largely driven by houseboats and jet skis.
But first, some news from around thin air country.
Opposition continues on the western slope of Colorado to plans for a greatly expanded presence of the Immigration and Naturalization Service. Last month, Carbondale denied a permit for a holding cell in a residential neighborhood, and in Durango, a new Latino Resource Center has launched a drive to keep the INS out of Durango.
Last month, Energy Secretary Bill Richardson announced that the massive uranium tailings pile at Moab will be moved out of the Colorado River floodplain. The new plan will end 20 years of debate over what to do with the tailings, which have been contaminating the river with heavy metals and ammonia. Previously, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission had wanted to put a cap on the tailings.
Environmentalists say the expansion of snowmaking at Colorado ski resorts is threatening the water quality of the Snake River. Arapaho Basin's plans for more snowmaking may go to court, and the Forest Service is concerned that the Keystone Resort is taking polluted water from the Snake for snowmaking, which then melts in a previously pristine creek.
Colorado legislators are making little progress in coming up with ways to slow down rampant growth. Meanwhile, local officials are meeting the issue head-on. Parker is the latest town to enact a moratorium on residential growth. Last month, Garfield County rejected the controversial Sanders Ranch project between Carbondale and Glenwood Springs. And Pitkin County has enacted its own moratorium on subdivisions, commercial uses, and homes larger than 3,500 square feet.
We talked to Commissioner Dorothea Ferris about whether Pitkin County's leaders are reflecting the wishes of its citizens. Ferris says most residents feel that growth in the Aspen area is out of control.
It's not in the commercial industry. It's not in the resort. So what is this growth impact that we're seeing?
Ferris says many rue that Aspen has become a construction economy instead of a tourist economy.
And someone might demolish a 2,000 or 3,000 square foot home and put up a 15,000 square foot home. Impacts of that were being felt, you know, for over a year. 10 pickups are parked on the road because they're working on the building of this large house.
Ferris notes that areas like the rural Crystal Valley are exempt from the moratorium, although they face growth pressures too. Ferris notes that moratoriums are nothing new in the Aspen Valley.
But when Pitkin County imposes a moratorium, people begin, oh my God, you're affecting my lifestyle and my income. And that's where the money is. That's the economic engine, not only for this valley, but we had people from Paonia, from Grand Junction, saying, you know, this is affecting my business, and we really don't want you to do that. And what we're trying to do is find a sustainable growth rate that can sustain the people living in this valley to avoid a boom and bust.
All of this, says Ferris, is caused by the spiraling demand for service labor in a resort economy.
Where you take 30 ski patrolmen or ski instructors to teach, it now takes 90 because people want more individual attention. So the demand for affordable housing has increased, the demand for facilities has increased, and we don't have the funding to provide industries. I mean, three people now open the door for me at the Jerome. I don't need that, but people want that. They take your skis, they open the door, they provide all these services. We have concierge at all the hotels. So all these services to meet maybe the same number of visitors and guests. One of the comments made at one of the hearings is that Aspen is the golden goose, and you're trying to cut off the financial supply from that town. People come in with money, and they leave it in Pitkin County, and it is spent here, and it doesn't come from here. Isn't that good? Well, some of us don't think that's all healthy.
Pitkin County Commissioner Dorothea Ferris. There will be, accordingly, amendments to the Pitkin Growth Management Plan.
Thank you.
Some people don't like to take any crap from tourists. Here's a report from Jack Perrin, a volunteer DJ at KVNF in Paonia.
In the first known case of dump and run in Crawford, town employee Gabby George turned eco-hero as he and his partner, Jim Rowe, witnessed a Missouri motorist dumping his RV waste tanks on Main Street.
So we took out after him, and I mean, he had really put the pedal to the metal, because, and he knew he was in pursuit.
As the sewage suspect approached Hotchkiss, Gabby George realized he could neither catch nor overtake him, so he came up with a plan.
He took off towards Delta, and I was hoping that the Hotchkiss Marshal, Mick Baxter, would be at the coffee shop, and Robert Short stopped down there, and sure as the world he was. So I pulled in there and ran in there, and I told him I needed him right away. He jumped out of his chair, and he got on the phone to the Delta County Sheriff's Department.
The poopy perpetrator was apprehended by the Delta County Sheriff at the Gas Mountain Delta. A citation was issued, and true to Western-style justice, he was hauled back to Crawford to clean up the mess.
Boy, there was toilet paper and feces, and I suppose there was 55 or 60 gallons of sewage. He got his broom out and his dustpan, and he got a trash can, and he swept up all of the paper and feces. And
no stranger to law enforcement, Gabby George is known to most Western Coloradans for his auctioneering talents. And though he has yet to receive any rewards for his civic action, he's pleased that justice was served.
And it's pretty neat. I've got some neat letters, you know. Good job, Gabby. And just the thing that I wasn't going to allow that guy to get away with dumping raw sewage right in front of the Crawford Town Hall.
When Ed Abbey first proposed tearing down the Glen Canyon Dam, he was considered a bona fide nutcase. But in Utah, a movement to drain Lake Powell is gaining steam. In Moab, Rory Tyler talked to river scientist Dave Wegner, who's involved with the Glen Canyon Action Network.
Dave Wegner is a scientist who has been studying the Colorado River system, including the Grand Canyon and Lake Powell, for over 20 years. He's worked for the Department of Interior and the Bureau of Reclamation, and is on the board of directors for the Glen Canyon Institute, an organization devoted to draining Lake Powell and restoring Glen Canyon. Dave, why do you think Glen Canyon should be restored?
Probably three very simple but very basic reasons. The first is to provide the opportunity for native fish species, bird species, and plant species to re-inhabit areas that they traditionally have utilized. The second reason is that with Glen Canyon Dam in place, the long-term ecological sustainability of Grand Canyon is endangered. And last but not least, restoring Glen Canyon would allow the waters that would naturally flow downstream to support the Colorado River Delta and ultimately the Sea of Cortez to be restored.
How does Lake Powell threaten the Grand Canyon?
Well, Lake Powell traps over 95% of the sediments that used to come into the Grand Canyon. Those sediments were the life support system that sustained not only the plants, but the insects that lived on those plants, the birds and the amphibians that fed on those insects, and then ultimately the underwater habitats that our native fish utilized.
And what about the Sea of Cortez?
The flushing ability of the water to take the salts out into the Sea of Cortez are not happening. The result today is that the Sea of Cortez, the Colorado River Delta, are dying.
Dave, what impact would draining Lake Powell have on the availability of water and power in California and Arizona?
Well, essentially there would be no impact to California and Arizona in terms of the water.
So who are the winners and the losers if the lake is drained?
Well, the Glen Canyon Dam and the reservoir we call Powell is really the dowry of the Upper Colorado River Basin states. It allows them to control the amount of water that is released downstream. Without Glen Canyon Dam in place, the Upper Basin states would lose some of their control ability over how much water the downstream states get.
And, of course, recreational users.
The type of recreational use that is made of the reservoir would change. No longer would it be an environment that is largely driven by houseboats and jet skis. Instead, it would go back to being a type of recreational resource that would you'd see more of the river rafters, the canoers, the backcountry hikers, the people who enjoy the wilderness for what it is.
How long will it take to drain Lake Powell if it actually happens, and how long will it take the ecosystem to substantially recover?
We are suggesting that it would take up to 10 years to drain the reservoir. We say that because it would take that long in order to not cause catastrophic impacts downstream in the Grand Canyon and throughout the rest of the lower Colorado River system. However, restoration will begin immediately as the reservoir begins to drop. In the side canyons, it will occur very quickly in the time frame of perhaps 6 months to 12 months. In the main portion of the Grand Canyon, of Glen and Grand Canyon, it could take upwards of 30 years before you'd see restoration accomplished.
From Moab, this is Rory Tyler.
Wegner and other environmentalists are holding a day of action in Page, Arizona on March 14th.
Durango has always been a friendly, welcoming kind of town, but some say things aren't quite so friendly in the La Plata County Jail. Here's a report from Brian Bayhuth, news director at KRZA in Alamosa.
Mark Silverstein, chief legal officer of the Colorado ACLU, first investigated the La Plata County Jail in November 1999.
We got letters from prisoners that told us about conditions that sounded almost as though there was like a medieval dungeon in the La Plata County Jail. Prisoners reported that they were chained to a wall for as long as 6 hours at a time for the most minor of infractions, that they were chained face down to the concrete floor of the drunk tank that reeked of urine and vomit, shackled with ankles chained and wrists chained. I learned of the use of an electric stun gun, and actually read an incident report in which an officer described shocking a prisoner twice with an electric stun gun while the prisoner was chained to the wall. The prisoner was stunned because he wouldn't stop mouthing off to the officer.
No one has ever been injured in this facility by any restraint device.
That's La Plata County Sheriff Duke Sherrard. Sheriff Sherrard disagrees with the ACLU's assessment of his jail. When asked if prisoners in his facility have been locked to the wall and zapped with a stun gun, the sheriff responded this way.
Let me put it this way. We do have the electric restraint device here. We have also other restraint devices. And when a prisoner goes out of control, we have to, number one, defend ourselves and guarantee the safety of the other prisoners.
Sheriff Sherrard says that using the stun gun is an infrequent event.
And I want to emphasize that in 6,828 prisoners who've been through here in the last 3 years, which is a period of time the ACLU investigated, no one has ever been injured in this facility by any restraint device.
Mark Silverstein disagrees.
These incidents they're not by any means isolated. The practice of punishing inmates by chaining them to the wall had been regular and routine. So routine, in fact, that officers did not even bother to write incident reports when they punished a prisoner by chaining them to the wall.
Silverstein describes how Amnesty International became involved.
I contacted Amnesty International, and they found out what had prompted my request. They put out what they call an urgent alert about the allegations in the La Plata County Jail.
Natasha Nimadal of Amnesty International Colorado describes Amnesty's action.
The action that has been taken recently was an urgent action was released by the London office, and that was sent to various Amnesty chapters and groups around the world.
Some 50 letters have been sent to the sheriff. Sheriff Sherrard has this to say.
These individuals from Amnesty International, I'm sure they are well-meaning and sincere, sensitive, concerned people. They only know what the ACLU has perhaps told them, and in my knowledge, all the ACLU did was kick into business this letter-writing campaign. And so we haven't hurt anyone. We're not going to hurt anybody. We don't want to hurt anyone, but we have to maintain control of this facility, and we will.
A full internal investigation of La Plata County Jail policies is currently underway. A final report is due to the La Plata County Commissioners sometime in March. This is Brian Bayhuth in Alamosa, Colorado.
You're listening to Thin Air.
A moratorium on prison building has failed to get through the Colorado Senate, but there's a growing movement against filling up prison beds through antiquated drug laws. May Jarrell reports from the Capitol in Denver.
Colorado's prisons, bulging at the seams, had representatives at the Joint Budget Committee to ask for more money to deal with ever more prisoners. In fact, this year, Colorado has budgeted over $600 million to prison construction and operation. Boulder Senator Dorothy Rupert says it's time to put the brakes on the skyrocketing prison population and has introduced Senate Bill 104, calling for a moratorium on new prison construction and the formation of a sentencing commission to review our sentencing policies, especially in reference to illegal drug violations. A former teacher, she says the focus by law enforcement on nonviolent drug offenses is sending the wrong message to the children. Christy Donner works with the Prisoner Rights Project of the Rocky Mountain Peace and Justice Center in Boulder.
1 in 3 women and 1 in 5 men who were sentenced to prison last year were sentenced for a drug offense, and it's the largest class of felons in prison. We're really talking about policies that are targeting poor communities of color, and I think that is evident in the numbers of people of color who are in prison.
Children of parents behind bars are more likely themselves to wind up serving prison time. Joanne Belknap, author of the book The Invisible Woman, Gender, Crime, and Justice, and professor of women's studies and sociology at the University of Colorado, says money spent on helping people before they get into trouble makes more sense than locking them up afterwards.
One girl who was about 11 said that when she was 7, her father had died. He was shot, and I was the only other one there, and he died with his head in my lap. What's disturbing to me is here is somebody who is clearly at risk for having emotional and psychological problems, at risk for becoming a delinquent, and yet didn't receive the services.
Prisoners in some correctional facilities face substandard medical care, exposure to infectious diseases such as TB and AIDS, violence, and sexual assault. In fact, Amnesty USA has determined that in many U.S. prisons, standard operating procedures and conditions represent cruel and unusual punishment. Julia Yu, an attorney with the newly created Law Center for Women Prisoners, gives an example of a woman prisoner who was denied critical medical care.
The client was pregnant at the time. She knew there were problems with the pregnancy, but she was denied all medical care whatsoever. And when her water broke, a nurse came, just took her pulse and said, "You're fine, go back to bed. You're making trouble." And by the time they got her to an emergency room, she had had a miscarriage already in her cell all by herself.
Between 1980 and 1994, women's incarceration rates almost quadrupled, while the men's rates doubled. Ari Zavaris, Director of Public Safety for the state of Colorado, says the need for more prison beds is regrettable but real.
Literally, people are afraid to go out at night when they're afraid to look at people sitting in the car next to them at a stoplight for fear that someone will whip a gun out and crack a round off at them. All the traditional things that you've heard. I don't think we had any choice.
Zavaris says he doesn't think Rupert's plan for the creation of a sentencing commission has much of a chance in this year's political climate. For Thin Air, this is May Jarrell in Boulder.
Colorado's landscape photographer John Fielder has 30 previous books to his credit. His latest is an homage to William Henry Jackson, who photographed a very different Colorado 100 years ago. Marilyn Gleason reports from KAJX in Aspen.
From an initial inventory of 10,000 of Jackson's historic photographs of Colorado landscapes and settlements, Fielder culled 300 compositions to duplicate. Then he set out with camera and tripod to complete the project in just 1 year. The results can be seen in the Colorado History Museum exhibit in Denver and in the book Colorado 1870 to 2000. Finding the divots from Jackson's tripod a century later wasn't always easy, but Fielder developed some techniques for precisely recreating his compositions.
About half the time, there was a caption in the bottom left-hand corner of the Jackson print. It would say Leadville or Glenwood Springs, something that I did recognize. Sometimes the caption wasn't recognizable. There was a lake that it took me 5 months to find called Lake Brennand. What I would do is I became a detective, essentially, for a year using clues in his photographs. The first thing I'd do is look for a geophysical feature or a building, if there were still historic buildings left, that would give me a starting point. When I found that mountaintop in my own purview when I went to that place, then I had to take another geophysical feature and line the two of them up in my purview with relation to perspective the way they were lined up in Jackson's photograph. And that meant either hiking or driving forwards and backwards, sideways, up and down, whatever it took, and sometimes that was a matter of feet, sometimes it was a matter of miles, to create the same visual relationship between two or more points within that photograph. And once I did that, then I'd be within, say, 50 yards, 100 yards of where I needed to be. And then if there was actually some foreground in Jackson's photo, say a particular rock that still existed today, then I could actually plant my tripod exactly where his was.
156 of the 300 pairs of photos appear in the impressive coffee table book. At the Colorado History Museum in downtown Denver, 60 scenes compare the present to a past that is quickly slipping out of memory. Fielder traveled more than 25,000 miles and hiked another 500 miles to find and photograph the same scenes. What is the biggest agent of change to the landscape in the last 100 years?
The change created by human beings, whether you want to call it development or sprawl or whatever, or ranchetting of ranches.
The message he delivers is a warning. Without aggressive and intelligent land use policies, Fielder believes Colorado's natural beauty, long valued as a source of spiritual renewal, will be lost in just a few years. Using his visual record of a century of change, he illustrates our ability to succeed in our goals, whether we choose to squander land with sprawling developments, to preserve it through managing wilderness, or even to reclaim developed land and return it to a pristine state.
Geology, you know, has not changed. The biology has changed. I believe, though, that this place is so different now than it was then because of the number of people that have moved to this state. You know, we think about mining and we look at the vestiges of the mining days, whether it's tailings or mine dumps all around the state. And, you know, those are remarkable, and they've defined the character of this place, at least as of the 19th century. But if you look today at valleys like your own Roaring Fork, or especially the Eagle River Valley from Vail to Glenwood Springs, it's pretty darn clear that that this place is wholly different than it was in Jackson's day. And if your values in life relate to the solace one gets from an open space or a hike along a creek or fishing on the Roaring Fork River without intrusion from man or man's structures, it's pretty darn alarming and shocking.
Colorado 1870 to 2000, published in September, is now in its third printing. The exhibit will remain at the Colorado History Museum through August 2000. For Thin Air, I'm Marilyn Gleason.
Life in the Four Corners is still very much influenced by culture that came over on Spanish galleons. Connie Gotch reports on a historical reenactment in Santa Fe.
Actress Rosalia Trajana, currently employed by the Museum of International Folk Art in Santa Fe, is taking a part of a housewife there in 1815. Dressed in a bright colored skirt and blouse and wrapped in a black shawl, she extends her hands and invites me into her casa colonial.
Me llamo Doña Herminia, pero todos los niños me llaman Tía Herminia.
1815 roughly marks the end of the Spanish colonial period in New Mexico, and the Santa Fe Trail would open, bringing commerce and contact from what was then the United States. That would bring civilization to the remote frontier, right? Well, through Tía Herminia, Casa Colonial's curator Robin Gavin desires to clear up some misconceptions about that idea.
They were isolated geographically, but they were not isolated. A lot of traffic was going up and down the Camino Real, and we wanted to show specifically how much in contact people really were with the larger metropolitan centers of Mexico City, Durango, and Chihuahua.
Tía Herminia proudly shows a blue and white vessel that looks very Chinese, but actually comes from Puebla, Mexico, where artists have copied Chinese designs from original pots brought to China from Manila and finally to Mexico by Spanish galleons.
And this is a prized possession. Not everyone has one of these, but everyone has a chocolatera and a molinillo for mixing the chocolate. And I love that sound because it means soon we will have chocolate.
A chest holds a silk shawl from Manila, gold filigree earrings from Spain, and a tortoiseshell comb. The style perhaps harkens to the head coverings worn by Moorish women.
Also, the Mediterranean has such a big influence on the way we live. These houses, you notice we have only two chairs. We sit mostly on the banquitos or the very low to the ground or on the floor. In the Mediterranean world, in the Middle Eastern world, where it's warm, people sit close to the floor. A lady sits a certain way. She's arranged and her skirts are arranged a certain way.
Because the Moors were in Spain for 700 years, they heavily influenced both the architecture and the material culture. And there are things that were introduced here in New Mexico by the Spanish, like the horno, the beehive-shaped bread oven that many people believe was a Native American invention, was actually introduced by the Spanish when they first came here in the 1500s.
But though Tía Herminia leads a gracious life, and her people are contributing much to what will become the American Southwest, still her existence is hard.
I'm getting up there now. I'm in my 40s.
They lived up into their 70s, but it was probably more the exception than the rule.
But we stay healthy and work, right, too? You know, for a very long time, because it's a very healthy life. It's outdoors. We work hard. We do physical work. Many of the children's games center around work. The love that these people have for each other, for the land, for their life, is maybe the most beautiful thing this culture has that we have to offer ourselves.
At the Museum of International Folk Art in Casa Colonial with actress Rosalía Trajana and curator Robin Gavin.
Thanks once again for listening. Thin Air is a project of the High Country Community Radio Coalition.
Funding comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from your local station. Tune into Thin Air this month for another roundup of regional news from your small town and rural community radio stations. On the March edition, hear about the movement to stop building prisons in Colorado. Also, prisoners say they are mistreated in Durango's county jail.